Okay, here we go. Welcome, each one of you. Pranam from Tigre in Argentina. Last week I was at Bajo Flores, my hometown. Now I'm in Tigre, which is one of my many devotional hometowns, the last one when I was living here in Argentina. So visiting some Vaishnav friends over here. I'm very glad to visit each one of you today, extending some warm hug from this particularly little spot of the planet Earth to your own unique spots over there. So unique, just miraculous, the fact that from our corresponding little spots we can bring communion and we can feel each other as being part of one same table today. So thank you for being part of that miracle, if you think about it. It's miraculous, and thanks soon for that as well. So we'll begin with some words of invocation first. Why a few words to invoke presence and gathering our senses and our attention and our intention and gathering. Now, gathering again, it's not just getting together, but the gathering of our presence and focus and intention and attention, so we can have a thick moment together, so to say. We can invite someone to share a few words to bless the meeting today. Why not Gaur Charan Prabhu? Yes, why not? Please, Gaur Charan Prabhu, inaugurate today's meeting with some words of blessing.
Thank you, Lord, for bringing us together today in this worldwide Sangha that gives us great hope and enables us to realize ourselves. And God bless us going forward.
With that being said, the gathering has been officially inaugurated with the blessings by a blessed one, like each one of you are indeed. So if we are blessed, we can give blessings. So it's not a business of pride on giving blessings. It's just extending the blessedness that has knocked on our door and we have dared to open it. So as usual, you're invited to raise your digital hand if you have questions, quests, explorations, topics, inquiries of any sort, and I encourage you, if you have something already in mind, to do that ideally now, so I have some idea of how many hands we will have throughout the gathering. Though, of course, if something comes in the midst of it, it's also welcome. So far we have four of them, and we will try to do our best to honor your digital hand raised, your hand raised, your spirit raised, hopefully along with it. And we are beginning with Tattva Darshini from Germany. And then we'll go to the rest. So you can unmute yourself. Tattva Darshini, welcome.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. I'm so happy to be here again. I'm just reading the book of Richard Rohr, Falling Upward, and I really like it also. But I was a little bit wondering today, because it is said we have, or he says also in the whole mythology, we have to go really downwards through a crisis, whatever, so that we finally can come upwards to Krishna. So let's say like this in a simple way. And for me, it makes fully sense. And I also had experiences like this, and maybe we have several of them, I don't know.
Yeah, we
But I
do.
was brought. We do, yeah. But I was wondering, in our Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, I never heard something like this. So it's a little bit like, okay, chant and be happy. So it's more always in this happy mood and prasadam and this and that. But and that's also why actually my first suffering was even bigger, because I thought I'm the only one who is not able to get this. So it increased even my suffering till I realized, oh, I'm actually not the only one. So, but I would like to to hear from you a little bit some ideas in our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. How is this topic mentioned or living? I mean, of course, there are many examples, also Queen Kunti or so, where also she's also going through really quite challenges. But how is it expressed in our philosophy?
The topic of like crisis or the need to go down to so
To
we can
go
go
up to
upward and
Krishna.
so on. Okay. Well, thank you. Of course, first thing that I will say is that we don't want like to make a too much of a strong emphasis, like you always need to collapse you or when we speak about crisis, again, we have to be careful with words, right? I can say, yeah, we need to go through so many crises to grow, but crisis doesn't necessarily mean like the utmost, absolute, biggest tragedy every week, right? Because who can go through that? But crisis is basically a deconstruction, right? Something that breaks my preconceived notions, puts me outside of my comfort zone, that invites me to recalibrate and think again. And that should happen a lot of times. But again, that doesn't need to be labeled as a tragedy of the greatest type. If we get a taste for that, so to say, we kind of normalize disruption as part of the dance, right? Let's put it that way. No, normalize disruption as part of the dance, or as part of any discipline, right? I'm just finishing reading one book. Sorry, this one, very recommended one. Probably will do a Swami Reacts, free play. Improvisation in Life and Art. And it's a very interesting book. Starts speaking about Leela and speaks about Krishna Leela and play and improvisation and disruption and how in music we need disruption and to adjust to the disruption and then you end up in a new pattern. Of course, Father Richard Rohr will speak in many ways about that. He has this wisdom pattern of order, disorder, and reorder. And those are like, again, like archetypal symbols that are all over. I've tried to speak about that in my chapter on radical personalism. I don't remember the chapter name, number of the chapter, but it's a chapter of a doubt, uncertainty, paradox, right? Divine and knowing. So for me, it's very, very present in our tradition everywhere. Like, I mean, you're asking for some examples. I'll give a few. And again, I'm sure all of you know these examples, but maybe many times we may have not gone through those examples with certain articulation, with certain words, seeing them in certain way. Just there in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Beginning, first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there you have it. Arjuna's crisis. No, the chapter, the name of the chapter is Vishada Yoga. Vishada means something like despair. So Vishada Yoga is the yoga of despair, like implying. Then comes all the other yogas, right? Each chapter of the Gita is called yoga. Now, Sankhya Yoga, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Karma Sannyas Yoga, Dhyana Yoga, Vibhuti Yoga, and so on. The first one is Vishada Yoga, the yoga of despair. So it's right there, chapter one. Arjuna, existential crisis, big crisis. The whole chapter is Arjuna's crisis. So it starts with that situation, acknowledging, normalizing there is something called crisis. There is something called going downward, descending work, right before thinking about ascending and transcending. Now, as you say, sometimes we become addicted to just transcending. We don't want to anything to do with descent work, just transcend. Now, we want just happiness, happiness, happiness. But the Bhagavad Gita starts with the yoga of despair. It's not starting with the yoga of harmony, of happiness, of full joy. It starts with Arjuna thrown on the floor, crying like a baby, having thrown his bow and arrow and not knowing what to do with his life, and being confronted with it in very, very put in a very liminal space, very disconcerting. And that's how the whole book unfolds from that wellspring, so to say. He needed to touch that place. Again, he representing us, no? For him to get a new paradigm shift, he needed some structures of thought to collapse, some sense of identity to die along, so something new can be born over and over again. The word Amrita that many times we use, and it's very present in all our books. Bhakti Rasamrita is in the Brihadbhagavatamrita. Amrita means nectar immortality, but includes the word death, mrita. So implying something always needs to die before something gets reborn. Krishna in the Gita says happiness in sattva, with sattva is somehow a trailer of what comes beyond sattva. He says happiness in sattva first tastes like poison. No. So then there is some complexity and difficulty there. What's the main scenario of the Bhagavatam? The main narrative of the Bhagavatam is Parikshit Maharaj's story and Sukadev Goswami instructing him. How does it all begin? He is cursed to die in 7 days. That's pretty unsettling, right? So that's crisis. That's a very powerful beginning to the whole story. You are put in a very unprecedented situation, unpredictable. And from there, from that place of liminality, from knowing of descent, the whole thing starts. And I could give so many more examples. In terms of language, I will say that in our tradition, one of the two basic expressions that indicate this. I don't know about Teresa, but there's some microphones coming over and over again. So if you can pay attention to mute, or all of you to mute your microphones meanwhile. But if there are two terms that somehow symbolize this ongoing descent, ascend, is union and separation. Union and separation, right? Union could be the happy moment of union and the certainty of union and all that, the beauty of it. And then separation is separation with all the liminality and unknowing and pain. And again, union and separation is not limited to Radha and Krishna and the gopis in Golok Vrindavan. It's an ongoing pattern that we are invited to embrace where we are now. Union and separation can be translated as also certainty and uncertainty. So we are united, we are now here united with a sense of being, and at one point by life circumstances, we are separated from the image we had of ourselves, of our other people, because it's an outdated pattern that needs to die. We need separation from that, or we need a distance to gain a new perspective of what that was in order to return with fresh eyes. So many ways we can speak about union and separation. Again, we have it's up to us to invoke these terms responsibly, right? And again, going back to what we saw in the beginning of the Bhagavatam series, not to make a rigid, reductionistic, literal reading of all the things. Union and separation is when the gopis are not with Krishna, and then union is when they are with Krishna. That's it. That's union and separation. End of the conversation. No, that's your idea of that. And well, many times we unfortunately become trapped or even enamored by our ideas about things, even when they are suffocating us. So there is an ongoing emphasis on this, of trying to introspect again. Another example, let's go there. If this is not enough, let's go to the right at the beginning of creation with Brahma, sitting on the lotus. And that's a very symbolic section. Again, when I'm saying symbolic, I'm not denying that it actually happened in some way, but it doesn't cancel so many layers of archetypal content there. So Brahma sitting there, nothing around him. Imagine, try to picture yourself sitting in a lotus flower, and there's absolutely nothing. Nothing. Just you on a lotus flower. Probably most of us will want to jump from the lotus flower. I'm killing myself right now. It's too much uncertainty. What to do with my life? Right? And he's in that situation. What to do? And he starts to go down. Again, it's very symbolic. Go down. He's not going up. He's going down from the lotus stem and goes down and goes down and goes down. And that in part has a role. Eventually, he returns to where he goes when was in the lotus. But I will argue he returns transformed already by that going down. Even if we may think, oh, just he lost his time going out, down for hours in that lotus stem, nothing happened. So he returned back, he lost lots of hours. He could just have relaxed on the lotus. No. For me, the symbol there is by all that descent work. Try to read, we have to, again, as we talked the other day, we have to learn to read scripture in an interpretive way as well. Nothing is in vain. It's not just, oh, Brahma is going down the lotus stem. That's it. And then he returns and he sits. That's it. Nothing else happened. That's a literal reductionistic reading that misses a lot. So in that descent work, in that going down that comes as a result of his not knowing what to do, uncertainty, crisis, he goes down. And in that going down, somehow he gets closer to his source, because that lotus stem comes from the how do you say in English?
Navel, navel.
Navel, thank you, from the navel of Bhagavan. So that descent work is a way of saying I'm getting close to myself. Even if he didn't saw Bhagavan, but he was getting close by that exercise, and by him then going up, he was transformed on some level, and then he heard tapas. Oh, and tapas is a word that means fire, and he, or means introspection actually, but means fire. The fire of introspection, the fire of looking inward, the fire of withdrawing all your attention in so many directions and concentrating all that to the inner core of your being. So again, all that is descent work, not looking inside, looking inward, going down. And that's the image of what's going on at the beginning of creation, kind of the kickstart that set in motion the unfolding of the universe, like set the tone, which is all about, again, Brahma going down, then going up transformed, then being able to hear what was already being said, but he couldn't hear before he went down. And when he heard that word in itself was an invitation to another form of descent work. And eventually he re received so much illumination. And after that illumination, as we see in the Bhagavatam, he became the architect of the universe. But after the first products of his architecture work came, he got into trouble with a few things. Then he was invited to apply introspection again. And then he repented and learned the lesson, and then he messed up again. So all this is is part of the journey. It's part of the pattern. So there is an on, that's an ongoing process, and it's all over the tradition. But again, we need to have the language to identify those sections, to draw the lesson from those, so they do not become just a stale myth. Right, like a story we memorize, like you maybe memorize the story of Santa Claus when you were 4 years old, and you know it by heart. You can repeat it in 4 minutes, but there's nothing there. It's just like a memorized story. No, if we want to learn something, as you say in English, I like it's learn it by heart. But learn by heart doesn't mean commit to memory. Learn by heart, right? Not a retaining of data, but the playing out of the implications of every single of these moments that are depicted there. So it's there. It's there all over. And again, and contemporary authors, you refer to Richard Rohr, of course, he's from Franciscan mysticism. But I mean, in the Bible itself, nobody spoke like Richard Rohr, because that was not needed at that time. There was not that language. There was another world altogether. So he's speaking in a certain way in a certain time, and so shall we, right? So shall everyone learn to locate these patterns, ancient patterns, I will say, beginningless patterns, as we were talking also in our Bhagavatam series. These are ever existing realities, But every time and generation, it's the duty, the responsibility of each generation to locate those ancient beginningless patterns and name them accordingly in a relevant way, articulate them in a way that we can draw purpose and meaning in a relatable way to where we are here now in the times we are living. That's the duty of every generation. That's parampara, and that's what keeps the current current. But it's there all over. So yeah, we better get acquainted with that nuance of journey. Again, Rupa Goswami is saying all these emotions that are there in eternity in the spiritual world. And yes, they're all ecstatic and loving, and we don't have a clue what that means in one sense. We just hear the words, but it includes not only servitude and friendship and romantic love and paternal love, but it also includes anger, and it includes disgust, and it includes fear, all the things that we just generally label as negative and something we don't want in spiritual life, but they will be waiting for us in eternity in their full face, which is the whole face, wholeness. So that's for me part of the beauty, as we will say, and the messiness of the Jāsatakas' journeys to become whole, to embrace wholeness. As Carl Jung will say, I'm not so interested in the word transcendence as I'm interested in the word wholeness. Because transcendence sounds too vertical only. And maybe wholeness may sound too horizontal, so let's put the two together, no problem. But wholeness and holiness, right? So that's for me the big important chapter, and I try to make that case, strong case, in radical personalism. We are in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, we are adoring human-like human lila, fully human, fully divine lila, Nara lila. So that in itself invites for a full integration of our humanity, and sorting out humanity as full as possible in the context of divinity. We have no reason not to be human, especially in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, I will say, and every other tradition as well. So this descent work is very important. It's confronting what is not being seen. Again, Mahaprabhu is seeing Cetu Darpana Marjana. I'm just going to just draw random examples of the very first thing that appears there, the very first chapter of the Gita, Vishada Yoga, Yoga of Despair, the very first main story of the Bhagavatam, Parikshit Maharaj's crisis, the very first moment of creation depicted in the Bhagavatam with Brahman, all that we say. The very first thing ever written by Mahaprabhu that we know, Cetu Darpana Marjana, which basically means confront your subconscious mind. No? Because the very first word of the very first thing that Mahaprabhu ever wrote is Citta, Citta. Citta means the subconscious mind. And that's all about descent work, right? It means shadow work, as I also quote Jung in Radical Personalism, an art and ability. Deconstructing false values, dealing with the shed, the subconscious shed. Cetu Darpana Marjanam, clean the mirror of your subconscious. For that, first you need to know there is something called subconscious, how to walk toward the subconscious without becoming paralyzed in the attempt to do so, frozen, how to gain courage, what to do when the shed is open. And he's saying that's the very first result, effect, blessing of chanting the name of Krishna. Now we say we are told chant and be happy, but Mahaprabhu is saying Cetu Darpana Marjana. And one thing doesn't cancel the other, just we need to get a mature idea of happiness. Happiness is not just you're in harmony junkie or something. Everything is pink color, la la la. That's very superficial, that's very shallow, flat, right? It's boring. There has to be integration of all these other emotions and things and rich emotional landscape. So yeah, chant and be happy. And the very effect of chanting is that the dust from that mirror of the subconscious will be moved, and you will have to do something about it. And that's worthy of celebration. Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. All glories to the Sankirtan that is creating this crisis, so to say. By dusting, by sweeping the dust that was stuck there for millennia, And now starting at least to move. You're a mess because you're getting awareness. Oh, that's dust. I thought that was I. That was my fixed identity, as I thought the dust on the wall lying there for 3 millennia was the color of the wall. And now I'm realizing, oh, that was dust. There's something else. So what's the wall now? So who am I? So in one sense, the first effect of chanting the name in one sense throws you into an existential crisis. And it's okay. That's Mahaprabhu is mentioning that in the first line of Shikshastakam, just to normalize that. And that's part of chant to be happy. Again, real happiness is all comprehensive, all encompassing. No, it's not just like a very immature idea of harmony. Harmony, I mean, happiness is harmony. I like more the word harmony because it doesn't tend so much to misinterpretation as happiness may do. Harmony, it's a musical term, and harmony entails, like Srila Siddharmash will naturally say, different notes put together in a way that creates harmony. So complexity, diversity, things that appear to be contradictory, integrate them, include them in such a way that it creates a new level of harmony. Again, order, disorder, reorder. And then that reorder becomes an order that needs to be disrupted again. And then that will take us to a new order and to a new order. That's all over. I can continue on and on giving you examples, and I always do, and it's important that we remind each other of this. Last one, Rasa Lila, the zenith of the Bhagavatam. That's a beautiful example of this process of disruption, order, disorder, reorder, no? Gopis are in order at home, Krishna plays the flute, disruption, disorder. They just run after the sound of the flute, they meet Krishna, reorder. Wow. We are with him, union. Then Krishna tells them, go back home. It's too late. What are you doing here? I'm a single guy. You're all married ladies. Again, disruption, total disruption. What's this guy saying, sending us back home? How can he say that? He's very serious. And they start to argue with him and they defeat him in argument. So Krishna agrees for them to stay, reorder. Then start to dance and celebrate. And at one point, Krishna disappears, disorder. The gopis go crazy looking for him. They find Radha also in separation. They sing together. Then Krishna reappears, a new order, and so on and so forth, right? So it's in whatever place you want to look, you will find those patterns, right? So a few examples from our tradition, just to point to something actually universal, and hopefully we can how we can own the universal, no? We can make the universal particular to our own case, no? Because since something is universal, you have to particularize the universal. No? Okay, how this universal principle plays out in my day-to-day here and now. So I don't know if that helps the Darshini by an
Yes,
actual
yes.
question.
Yeah, it was a big, yeah. Unfolding many realizations, and also to realize, yeah, like in evolution, in divine love, love is in motion. So everything is up and down and changing. And if I can come to a point to really embrace this and to love this, then everything is okay. And it's simply life.
Yeah. And of course, there are things that are always the same, but the same in the good sense, not in the sense of static, as I also try to speak in the book, right? There's always something that is the same. Reality at its deepest is beautiful. That's always the same. But beauty is always increasing. So, no. What is always the same is beauty, but beauty is ever fresh and ever new. So, it's never the same beauty. It's always beauty, but never the same. So unity and diversity, Beda Ved. That's another way to speak about, no? Union and separation, order, disorder, Beda Ved, one and different. That's the name of our philosophy, basically, right? Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And let's share for a few minutes if you're invited to join us, for those who are joining us, if there's anyone for the first time. We are having breakout rooms in Zoom, breakthrough hopefully as well, so we can share our reflections in terms of the need for descent, the need for grounding, the need for exploring the underworld. The need not to be so much in a rush to transcend and be very high and very ecstatic, but doing groundwork, groundbreaking, and groundwork at the same time, no? So yeah, a few minutes in the breakout rooms, and those who for whatever reason cannot join, take a few moments to ruminate on this, and see you very soon again. Welcome back. Welcome, welcome you all. Welcome back. So take a few moments if you want to shift from one room to another, from one moment to another. It's all the same, it's all one, but also there is diversity in the oneness. And I hope you could were able to ruminate in the room. That's what rooms are made for, to ruminate. If not, you are not in the room, right? So we'll continue inviting those who have raised their hands, following the original order. And the next one was Sweated with Radhika from Ireland. Yeah, it's in Ireland. I know that background.
Yes, Maharaj, Pranam.
Pranam.
My question today is about the transcendental and immanent nature of God. You briefly said something in your response to the first question, regarding transcendence and wholeness. I think, at least from my perspective, it seems that there has been an emphasis on the transcendental nature of God. It's all about becoming transcendental, transcendental to the modes of nature and transcendental to everything, and somehow it seemed like it worked for people in the past. I don't know, but yeah, and now I'm seeing there's more of an emphasis for finding the presence of God, in this world and in our ordinary moments and things like that. And yeah, I'm seeing even many other spiritual traditions talk about this and kind of moving away a little bit from transcendence or something like that, or maybe balancing the two, I don't know. So how do you see it? Do you see it as a balance between the two in our daily practice, I guess, our life? What does it really look like? We often hear or read that God is present in every atom, but then at least for me it's more of a concept than really experiencing that, so what does that look like in a daily life?
No. Thank you. It's an important topic, and yeah, it's related to what we just talked. I just finished what I said at the end before was on the notion of Achintya Bheda Bhed. And we could easily connect Bheda Bhed with also God is both and, right? It's never either or. It's not transcendent or immanent. One or different, personal or impersonal, Madhurya or Aishwarya, right? Intimate or majestic, man or woman. That's our dualistic thinking, just playing itself out over and over again and filtering everything. And one of those dualistic patterns is transcendence versus immanent, right? We put the versus in between and we create the clash, this ourselves. Because we cannot yet accommodate these two dimensions of the same reality. So Bheda Bhed means God is one and different, which also means God is transcendent and immanent at the same time. Not at times one, at times the other, right? It's not like, okay, God takes turns to be immanent. Okay, now I'm transcendent. I'm no longer here in everything. Now I'm always here, but I'm nowhere else. And over again, that's all over our tradition, right? All over in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna giving all these examples of him being beyond everything and not beyond everything, and giving so many examples from nature. How can we think of him and also talking about the transcendent dimension, and I don't know, the Bharat and Krishna eating dirt, and everything is inside of Krishna, and Krishna is inside of that everything that is inside of him. So of course it's mind-boggling, right? Because basically we cannot approach reality through the mind only, through the thinking, rational, empiric capacities. So I think, and as you say, and I talked about that radical personalism. Actually, when you were asking the question, I just opened the PDF of radical personalism and I put the word immanence, and I had like a few options. You can try to do the same. I have one here. I like to read just one section that I found it. I say there. Well, that's a long thing, but I'm talking in terms of bit a bit, right? It's in page 334, which is more connected to unearthing heaven and finding God in immanence, because I agree with you, we have made a very good, quote unquote, good job in making God utterly transcendent. And this is not only a problem of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Every spiritual tradition generally has presented a very otherworldly idea of the divine, which is true, but it's only half the truth. And half-truths are more dangerous than lies sometimes, as they say, right? So if you say God is only man, you're in trouble. And if you say God is only woman, you're in trouble. If you say God is only transcendent, that's all half. You're cutting God half. And that's like amputating the unamputatable, right? So it's just our own limits projected all over. So here I'm saying the following, just a few lines. So I'm talking about bit a bit. Says, where to start? We will not be able to recognize God later if we cannot recognize God now. No? Immanence. Gaudiya Vaishnavas worship a sweet absolute who is both immanent and transcendent, simultaneously all-pervading and localized. Personal and universal. In fact, a truly transformative God, transformative for both the individual and history, needs to be experienced as both personal and universal. Another way of saying, again, immanent and transcendent. So I agree. I agree that sometimes, again, we have to do here the perennial exercise of distinguishing between what the tradition actually teaches and how it was presented to us. And I don't know how it was presented to each one of you. I'm sure it was not in the exact same way to any of us. And even if it was presented as a partial way, let's not be resentful, but let's not also throw the baby away with the bathwater, right? The tradition is never teaching exclusive transcendence. I mean, just the Bhagavatam, no? Vedanti tattva vidastattvam jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdite. So in those, and this is reality, the Bhagavatam say, tattva reality is known as Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. Bhagavan is mostly the transcendent God, the God absorbed in Leela, in divine play. Paramatma is more the universal consciousness. Brahman is the all-pervading spirit. So I will say Brahman and Paramatma have more to do with this immanent side. Bhagavan is more related to the transcendent side. Still, they are the same person. They are the same reality. But that's there, right there. I mean, we all speak over and over again Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, but sometimes, unfortunately, we speak about those three like if it were like some sort of competition, and always concluding Bhagavan is the highest Bhagavan. Like if Brahman and Paramatma were two separate guys, which actually we are talking about the same non-dual reality. So Brahman, Paramatma, they are all pervading, omnipresent, and Bhagavan is not different from that. But we will add to that that transcendent dimension, which creates the realm of Leela, of divine play and loving interaction, which makes for a personal, unique connection. Because at the same time, if I'm saying God is everywhere and it's Like, yeah, it's everywhere, and it's a beautiful idea just to sit with that for a minute, right? There's no place where God is not. Wow. That's mind blowing. You cannot think that. That's why every mystic will say you cannot think God. If you can think it, it's not God, basically. That's what Meister Eckhart said. If you can think about it, then it's not God. It's your thinking about God. That's not God. Your thinking about God is not God. Your ideas about the divine are not the divine. I'm not saying your ideas are wrong, but your ideas are not the full reality of what the sweet absolute is. So we should be very humbled by that. So I agree that historically, at least on based on some statistics and testimonies I've heard throughout time, there has been some how to say, not so balanced emphasis on God's transcendence, and that or creates a whole orientation to the practice about just going to that transcendence and getting out of here, because you have not been schooled. I mean, you. I'm talking in general. I'm not talking to you or to anyone. We have not been schooled enough about God's immanence and the sacredness of everything. So everything is profane around me. It's an obstacle. It's dangerous. It's mundane. I need to go to transcendence. And eventually, we realize transcendence is a realm of that we can inhabit here and now. And sometimes immanence is the first step into transcendence, right? Starting to perceive God, maybe in a more general way. And I've seen that process for some devotees, and I can imagine how for some of those who have been in that process, and I'm not the exception to that rule, it can feel like a regression. Like, okay, in the beginning you received a lot of emphasis about Krishna, Supreme Personality of Godhead, and now Swami Padmanabha writes this book, Radical Personalism, is all about personhood and God transcend. But maybe we didn't have enough foundation of the immanent dimension, not the sacredness of the world, of nature, God everywhere in it. So we may need to go from the particular to the universal. No, to something more generic in one sense, more abstract. God is everywhere, in every atom. No? And we may, some may still feel, I'm becoming hippie now, what's going on? I'm like, God is everywhere, and yeah. I mean, it's true. So we may need to go back there and to develop some firm grounding in that experience, because of course, the realization of Bhagavan Sri Krishna ideally should include all these other dimensions, but sometimes we do not include them. We just go to transcendence without proper grounding, going back to descent work. And we cannot sustain the transcendental dimension because we are not there yet, because it was not integrated enough. So we may need to, quote unquote, go back and emphasize more the immanent side, the universal side, the generic side. And it may sound more like, oh, am I becoming impersonal? I'm feeling more in need to connect with the God aspect in the world, in nature, in matter, in everywhere. But hopefully we do that in the service of transcendence, in the service of the sweet absolute, not to a point that, again, we throw the baby away with the bath water and we just remain with the more immanent side and there's nothing else. No, there is a clear notion of transcendence, and I can understand some traditions and not want to fall into comparison and triumphalism and this is better and this is worse, but some traditions do not have much clear depictions of transcendence. Let's be honest. There's not much to be said in some sister traditions about what's going on in transcendence. So no surprise that there will be a lot of more emphasis in immanence, because that's what they know and what's clear. Now, in our tradition, there's a lot of clear depictions of transcendence, but that's not enough for us just to hear that and jump and be there. We also need to do our immanence homework, and again, that's over all over there in the Bhagavatam and in our tradition, as I gave the examples of Krishna speaking about all these phenomena in nature, and he identifying that himself with those. The main Bhagavatam narrative, starting with Vishwarup, tried to see creation as divine. That's imminence all over and over and over. So I think, yeah, it's important. It's a, and it could be somehow also compared with Aishwarya and Madhurya, right? Aishwarya could be more related to immanence. Now, God's presence everywhere, the majestic side, the glory of the divine in every atom. And personal, for us at least, the transcendent personal will be more with Madhurya, with intimacy and personal. But Madhurya without Aishwarya is not Madhurya. So Aishwarya is what allows for Madhurya to be experienced. So in that same way, we need to be properly not only educated in theory, but experiential in tasting the sacredness of immanence, in getting into moments and places and experiences where we can feel the presence of the divine in what we have labeled as ordinary for so long. And sometimes all it takes is just go on a walk in nature. Just to give an example, right? Now, we don't need to become too complicated and develop like super complex systems to experience God's immanence. Just go for a walk in nature and of course try to go for a walk in nature, right? Don't bring like 300 devices with you and be chanting Jap and listening to a class and playing basketball and do three more things. No, go and be there. Allow the sacredness of nature to unfold, and that's part of God's immanence. And even again, just contemplating the idea, just sitting with it, like what Prahlad Maharaj said, right? Hiranyakashipu say, "Where is your God?" And he said, "Where is he not?" That's a pretty imminent answer. Even in that pillar, immanence that. Immanence 101. So even if we don't have a realization of that, but that's and the very interesting thing is that when we hear the symptoms of the highest devotee, Bhagavatam is saying, as the Bhagavad Gita is also saying, Yamam Pashyati Sarvatra Sarvam Chamai Pashyati, that person is seeing me everywhere and everything in me. Me and everything in me. That's very imminent. And that's a symptom of the highest devotee. So the highest devotee is not cut from transcendence, but transcendence includes immanence. That's the idea, as Madhurya includes Aishwarya. So again, these are not mutually exclusive. We don't need to create a battle where there is not. We don't need to draw a line, Kuru Pandava line, when there is not. Brahman and Paramatman are not in war with Bhagavan, right? Vaikuntha is not on war with Vrindavan. Immanence is not in war on transcendence. We are in war with ourselves. And from that inner division and fracture, we just project borders and walls everywhere. Everywhere. Vaikuntha, Vrindavan, Bhagavan, Brahman, no, nobody. Nobody's spoiled. So yeah, I try to share hopefully some balanced words in terms of acknowledging that, but also adding some caution in terms of not becoming just obsessed with that and discarding transcendence altogether, because there is transcendence as well. There is a beyond, if you will. But we may not be able to contact that beyond if we are not able to deal with what's in the immediate here and now. So yeah, just brief, whatever works better for each one of you, right? But just being in any moment and trying to bring that the sacredness of immanence wherever you are. That may help. Just pause for 10 seconds and have a micro prayer moment. The sweet absolute is everywhere, even here. You may add at the end, even here. Because we are quick to say it's everywhere except here. Except where I am. Who am I for him to be here, even here? Yeah, today I was in the bathroom, even there, right? Bathroom is, I, at one point I thought like, well, it would be interesting to write the whole book about the bathroom, right? The bathroom is a very interesting place because you spend so much time in the bathroom Probably apart from this holy shrine, like a temple, I was that the idea that came while me, I was in the bathroom doing bathroom things. And the idea was like, this is a very sacred place because no other room has seen me more naked, at least on some degree, than in a bathroom. And you are very vulnerable in a bathroom. You are in those doing those things that you don't want to be seen publicly doing any of that. So it's a bathroom. And you spend a lot of time with that. So you better bring some immanence to the bathroom and find sacredness there. Not like, okay, now I'm going to the bathroom, ordinary stuff, contaminated stuff in the bathroom, that's it. Well, you better change your angle of vision because you will spend lots of time in the bathroom. Lots of vulnerability going on in that moment, right? And people who are crying, they go running to the bathroom also. So in its own ways, its own form of shelter. Shelter and nakedness and vulnerability. So anyhow, I don't want to lose track of the answer, but it's all connected. I don't know if that helps. You tell me, Svetlana, if there's anything else that
Oh,
feels needed to bring.
it helps so much. Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. Mind blown, in short. Something that like really stood out to me was this, or an eye-opening thing was you relating it to the Paramatma and Brahman realms, like. You know, like I always thought it's not for us, you know, like we are focused on Bhagavan and Paramatma and Brahman are like different spiritual practice. So to like, you know, see that as no, we kind of need to bring balance, you know, that's also required. Like that's part of the immanence of God. And yeah, just one more thing I want to add is that you know, previously going for walks meant taking chanting bag along. You know, it's like couldn't
Taking
go.
what, sorry?
Chanting bag along. Like I couldn't really go without kind of like a guilt thing. Like, oh, I couldn't just go and enjoy nature, you know?
Oh,
But
when we were in Ireland, we went for walks, the three of us with Amanda, and there was no chanting. We had a nice walking there.
A foosball.
Yes, exactly. I meant previous to that.
One day we
Pre to
had this
that, yeah.
little ball. We were playing soccer along the way.
Yeah, and
We
you
get a little
keep it in
distracted,
some field.
sidetracked at that moment from the presence of immanence. What to do? Play, play king. Play is transcendence, right? The realm of play. So play transcendence and immanence there. Sorry, I got sidetracked by Amanda saying soccer there. I'm in
Yeah, I mean,
Argentina,
I
so
just.
my soccer DNA gets activated here more especially.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted, you know, I'm just expressing gratitude for, you know, being able to go on a walk now and still connect with God and see that as a spiritual practice and not have the guilt of not taking chanting bag along and just chanting, you know, just for the sake of it to feel okay. So, yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Okay, a few more moments. Let's go back to, I won't send you to the bathroom, but to another type of room to ruminate. Every room is for rumination. So let's go one more time to our breakthrough rooms and share a little bit about immanence, transcendence, and how do we navigate or misnavigate sometimes these dynamics in our life. And see you back soon. There you are. Back. Welcome. Hope you had a good time together. And let's continue. We have a few more raised hands and we want to honor all of them. So I think the next raised hand in the original order came from John, which is who is sitting at his backyard, if my vision is not failing.
It is not
So
failing.
greetings to the backyard and to the family. Always remembering the nice time spent there as well.
Yes, thank you. There's my
Now,
hammock I was in earlier.
there it is. Thank you for the darshan.
Well, I had a thought from last week that I was tempted to share.
But then you just spoke so lovely about transcendence and immanence that I'm like, do I want to continue to take us deeper into that jungle?
Up to you, my friend.
I think not, actually. So I'm happy to do either pass the microphone back to whoever was going to ask the next question, or Rasanghi just said something about work now, samadhi later. And for whatever reason, it brought my mind to the concept of Nishkama Karma Yoga. And I think the last I sort of like was really sort of systematically trying to study the Gita, I got caught in that area of like, not feeling confident in my work, so therefore definitely not feeling able to, be detached from the results. And now I'm discovering that by engaging with a kind of work that does make sense for me, and I am able to do, like, there has to be some basic competence, right? And then having that basic competence, then I'm much more able to say, I'm not ultimately in control. This is just, I enjoy doing this, And I don't know if there's something like maybe enjoyment is the unstated term in Nishkama Karma Yoga, that it's not just like, mandatory suffering or or like just, extreme asceticism or something. So that's a
Yeah,
thought.
we can share a few thoughts regarding, because before you pass, we pass the baton to someone else. I appreciate your point.
Thank you.
I mean, first of all, you mentioned this line that Rasanghi invoked, work first, samadhi later. And of course, I've heard that quote being presented in 108 different contexts with 108 different intentions. So that's always the danger of one-liners, that you may have heard them, who knows from whom, and that person used that in which particular context, which can be accurate. I'm not saying it was not accurate. I'm just saying, just watch out for one-liners, and the text out of context become pretext too. Because sometimes I've seen that line like weaponized to the point of you cannot go into very deep exploration of your tradition because you are not holy enough, pure enough, and you need to work first and you need to earn. And it becomes more like this earning, deserving system, so to say. And that was not the intention of that quote. No? But I appreciated the context in which it came, and you're exploring it and connecting it with Nishkam Karma Yoga. And I appreciated the point you made about how you couldn't be detached from the fruit of your labor if, to begin with, your labor was not suited to your nature, right? So you were too disturbed, so to say, engaged in something that was not too natural. So in that disturbance, you cannot even think about, on top of that, being detached from the, I mean, you are actually wanted to be detached from what you are doing because you're hating it.
Yes.
Right? So someone comes, and on top of that, be detached of the from the fruits of the things you're doing, that you, no, it's like too much. And that's why, ideally, again, I'm talking from a little idealistic perspective, but the first step is not so much be detached from your work, but first is engage in a work that is suited to your nature. As much as possible. Again, I don't want to sound too naive, but at least try it. Well, let's try to. And that's the first basic lesson of in the Bhagavad Gita many times. It's like, learn to be yourself. Learn to discover who you are, not in terms of soul and the ultimate potential of soul in bhakti. That's another PhD conversation, if you will. First, you have an acquired nature, you have a psycho-emotional body, and you cannot just, like, again, jump to transcendence and leave that behind. So you have to embrace that, integrate that, and engage that properly. So for that, we have to scan, so to say, and detect and acknowledge, okay, what's the type of mind and emotional disposition, and the particular, if you want to say, the unique way in which the gunas are combined in my psyche, that creates this sense of personality, which again, I'm not saying that's eternal, but it's there, and it's not leaving tomorrow. So I need to be able to ascertain what's the terrain, psycho-emotional terrain there, and on that foundation, accepting myself in order to change whatever I need to change, accepting where I am, because that's the only safe place to do any change, accepting where you are now. And from there, we can change everything. But first, you have to accept everything before you want to change anything. So, acceptance, recognition, acknowledgement, then hopefully engaging in some relatively aligned vocation. I don't know. I'm thinking about my teenage years. And I mean, if someone will say, Swami, you have to go to a normal work and have a boss and be in the bank and in the, I will have shot myself in the head right now. I mean, it was like absolutely inconceivable. I mean, there was no place for that. Not possible. It was so much other, it was like, yeah, it was not possible. And I ended up becoming a Hindu monk, so kind of punk. Confirms that, yeah, it was not for me, the bank stuff. I have nothing. If you're working in a bank, all glories to you. I have nothing against that. I'm just saying, try to be aligned with your acquired nature. And one acquired nature is not better than the other. There are just acquired natures, and we should not also over-identify with ourselves with that either. But we should identify them enough so we can be a functional human being in society. And we are not spending our whole life working on something you hate, because if not, you grow resentful. I mean, if you do something you hate for 8 hours per day for 5 decades, I don't think you will be a very charming person in your old age. I mean, you have grown hating something every day for most part of your day. So that's not a desirable frequency to be in. So that's why. Again, and I'm trying to be realistic. Sometimes there are emergency cases, and scriptures speak about apadharma, which basically means you have a dharma, you have a nature, try to act according to nature. But there is emergencies, and in emergencies, you can switch to being the bank office guy to becoming a fireman or whatever, right? But watch out not to make the emergency the norm, because that may start to really get in the way of your psyche. So yeah, when that's relatively in place, then we can begin the conversations of detachment from the fruits of your action. Why? Because it will be easier to be detached from the fruits, because the whole philosophy of detachment from the fruits of your action is that the fruit in itself is the action. But for that, you have to love what you are doing. If I love what I'm doing, it's easier for me to understand, yes, this is the fruit. I love this. But if you hate what you are doing, and I'm telling you that thing is the fruit, the very fruit, you don't need anything else, and you're hating it, right? It's like, no way. So that's why we have to be careful how to speak about these things to people, because again, if they are now in a chapter in their life that they are hating what they are doing, I cannot just talk to them about just love what you're doing, don't care for the fruit. I mean, first things first. And again, here we are not talking about bhakti yet or any other dimensions, and there are so many dimensions to it. And all this, I think, is are for most of us, though bhakti is independent and bhakti can reach us anywhere, wherever we are. But I will say that for us to be wholesome enough to take advantage of that reach from bhakti to us, we have to be in a relatively balanced position. That's why our acharyas have emphasized so many times, try to live in sattva as much as possible, which means basically try to be a balanced, equipoised, satisfied human being to some degree. Again, there are ups and downs and stuff, but try to be in that. So whenever bhakti comes, divine love comes, you have some considerable foundation of balance, equilibrium, so you can receive that. But if not, yeah, we may need to pay attention to that. So yeah, in that case, work first, samadhi later. Yeah, work first, but work first doing something that is relatively relatively aligned. Again, maybe not entirely aligned, because sometimes we can also go to the extreme of daydreaming and we portray in our minds an ideal, a scenario that is so ideal that it will never happen. At least it will never happen until and unless we go first through some not so ideal scenarios, but also not so dysfunctional scenario. So there is always some difficulty, some challenge, some effort, right? Like, I don't know, in my teenage years, going back to my teenage years, I was a musician. I wanted to live as a musician at one point. But unless it's something very karmically extraordinary, you won't, most musicians do not make a living out of music. And if you make a living out of music, you better practice and sit with the instrument 15 hours per day and play and so many other things. So there's hard work before you reach the ideally conceived scenario, which may happen, may not happen, right? But there's something for us to do also. So that's also a balance, right? It's not just like, okay, I will look for my vocation according to my nature and everything will flow smoothly and there's no effort. Everything will be so flowy and natural. There will be still work to do. There will be still so much work to do. But still, that so much work to do has to happen in a relatively aligned scenario, vocation-wise, right? To some degree. And then we can talk about, then basically, we may not even need to talk much about get detached from your fruit. Because you are, again, so much enjoying what you are doing that you are not even thinking about the result of it because you are feeling the immediacy of the result that is coming by doing what you love. And that in itself is a very unique preview of how to deal with bhakti, because bhakti is basically in that sense the same. You are doing what you love doing, what you want to do for eternity, and you are not doing bhakti for nothing else but bhakti. So in one sense, do your dharma for the love of it, not for the fruit. It's a very preliminary preparation for embracing bhakti with that same spirit. Because if not, you end up doing bhakti because and you hate bhakti. Right? I'm doing this service or this sadhana and I hate that, but I want the fruit, which I imagine is different from what I'm doing, and that's not the bhakti we are invited to practice. That's so yeah. I don't know if that helps. That was cool topic, John. Thank you for bringing it.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like there's so much more to say, but it's a pleasure listening to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Rasangi, for the one-liner, the one-line trigger. Okay, let's keep one breakout room so we honor the two remaining raised hands from Sam and Manjulali So first Sam. So we travel from Virginia to Wales in a moment. There we are. Welcome, Sam.
Hare Krishna Maharaj and everyone. I wanted to ask. I was reading Krishna book yesterday, and I've got it here. The chapter is when Krishna and Balaram go to release Nanda Maharaj from Varuna's clutches. So, but afterwards, it's described that Krishna. Prabhupada describes that that Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda, they can't see that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They just see he's their little boy. So my question is that as it goes on, some of the cowherd men are like, is he really the Supreme? And can he give us salvation? So my question is, if Nanda Maharaj and the other cowherd men are all eternal associates of Krishna, why did Krishna reveal to them the spiritual sky?
Okay. Thank you, Sam. I'm glad that your readings always bring some questions. That's important. That's a good reading exploration. You are not reading casually. There are some things that you want to understand better. So that's a beautiful section, very interesting section. One of many, as we know, again, going back to Aishwarya and Madhurya and so on, where Krishna is overtly showing Aishwarya, right? Because Nanda Maharaj is kind of kidnapped by the agents of Varuna, and eventually Krishna appears into the scene, long story short, and Varuna and all these big personalities, cosmic personalities, start to offer prayers to Krishna, right? In front of Nanda Maharaj. So Nanda Maharaj is being released from prison, so to say, by his young boy, and the ones who had imprisoned him start to praise the young boy and worship him. So again, this happens a few times throughout the Brajalila dynamics to create this tension between Aishwarya and Madhurya, and to highlight the point of to highlight the unique psychology of the Brajavasis, like Bishwanath Chakravarti Thakur so beautifully highlights in Raghavartma Chandrika, that he's saying that he gives the example of boiling milk, and milk is boiling, and if you throw a straw in the boiling milk, that straw disappears completely in the boiling milk. You will never see it again. So he says the love of the Brajavasis, their madhurya, their intimacy, their boiling love, no, is like that milk. And the Aishwarya, or even the momentary perception, as you say, some asking, is he God? They praise him as that's like the straw. Okay, you can sit for a moment. Is he God? Swallowed by the the boiling milk of the Brajavasis affection and gone forever. That's it. That's how it works for the Brajavasis, right? Similar to the Govardhan Lila again. Very, in one sense, it's a very sweet Lila, but it's a very Aishwaric Lila. Krishna has 7 years soul. He's lifting this heel with a pinky finger for a week, the weakest arm. He's already weak. He's defeated in wrestling every single day. Weak in the Lila. And for a week doing this extraordinary feat, and the whole of Vrindavan is witnessing that unblinking for a week. So there's no point of denying he's doing such an Aishwaric thing. But nobody thinking in terms of Aishwarya, just their Madhurya is increasing. Right? For other devotees, it's different, right? When Vasudeva and Devaki see Krishnananda born, they start to pray to him as Bhagavan. No? When Arjuna sees Krishna's universal form, he got scared. But Brajavasis witness all that, and somehow or other their madhurya increases, their intimacy. Now, as I always give the example, right? Krishna is doing all these Govardhan feats, and at the end of the Govardhan Lila, also some of the elders come to Nanda Maharaj, like it happened with Varuna. Like, I mean, your son just did something just very godly. Maybe not God with capital G. Okay, let's not be that wild. Let's not go that far, but maybe he's a god, no? With small g, some universal deity, I don't know, some superhuman being. What do you think, Nanda Maharaj? Nanda Maharaj has just he puts the debate to end in 1 minute or something. Like, I mean, he say, I know Krishna, I know God, I worship God every day in my altar, Narayan. Narayan is very peaceful, very stable, very godly, very transcendent, very divine. Krishna is the exact opposite of all that. He's unstable, he's lying, he's stealing, he's crying, he's unsatisfied, he's always asking for more sweets. He's not aware of his extramarital dimension, right? That's another conversation that we'll have with the gopis. So he's not God. I mean, look at him. And that's the end of the conversation. I said, yeah, of course. And the conversation ends, but everyone is more charmed by Krishna than by God, of course. Of course, Krishna is God. Or let's put it that way. God is an aspect of Krishna, as I like to say. God is one aspect of Krishna. And Krishna is not an aspect of God. It's the other way around for us. So in this, going back to the Leela with Varuna, of course, at one point of the Leela, there is this sense of, and this is the main intention regarding your question, right? Krishna is showing them transcendence. Basically, that's the idea. Like some for a moment, from a moment, this straw is seen in the boiling milk. Oh, Krishna is such an extraordinary person. Can you please show us our next life? That's basically the idea. And Krishna basically, I mean, what he does, if you read in between the lines, what Krishna is showing to the Brajavasis is kind of he's putting a mirror in front of them. In other words, the Brajavasis are there. Family people with their families, with their cows in Vrindavan, with Krishna. And Krishna shows them, what's eternity for me? What's my next life? And he puts a mirror, like saying, you're already doing what you want to do forever, right? Like, this is how it looks like. And they are like basically seeing themselves in where they are now. And they are like absolutely delighted. It's like, wow, cool. I mean, they are not saying we are doing what we want to do forever, but that's they are walking the talk. They are walking it so badly they don't even need to say it. And that's basically the point of that moment, to show that, again, what we were saying a moment ago, you are not doing bhakti for the sake of something else. It's not that the Brajavasis want to go to Vaikuntha, to Brahman, to they are not interested in any of that. They are so charmed and satisfied with what they have. So when Krishna shows to them, he doesn't show to them anything different from what do they already have. Like saying, I mean, what you have is already, that's the gift, no? Where you are is that's it, no? And they agree. They're like, yeah, they're not looking for anything else. Even again, if in the context of the Lila, it sounds like they are curious. So what's our next life? What's in the beyond? It's just part of the charming tribe-like expressions. But when basically Krishna is showing them the same situation they are already in, and they're absolutely not only fine with that, but that's like, yes. Any other thing will have been disturbing because they cannot think of anything else but the lifestyle they have chosen, going back to doing what you love, right? So it's somehow there, it's a recurring theme now here. Try to live your life, as I like to say. Try to embrace a lifestyle that is sustainable in eternity. Let your current lifestyle be sustainable in eternity. Live your daily life in a way that's plausible in transcendence, because that's how it works for bhakti. Again, we are ideally bhakti, bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. Bhakti comes from bhakti, bhakti goes to bhakti. So we want more of the same, which is never the same, of course. But we have to start here and now. So let's try to live more and more gradually, sustainably, but a more and more coherent life that at one point it becomes so fully aligned with the dynamics of eternity, that when that happens, you are there. That's it. Right? When you live a life that is fully attuned with the life that is plausible and sustainable in eternity, that moment you have attained that lifestyle in eternity. You don't need like some official transference. Okay, now you are being transferred by this mothership to this planet. It's all about aligning more and more coherence. Aligning with a certain constellation, so to say, and when you're in the proper place, you're there. You find yourself there. Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. So that's basically what the Lila is teaching, right? With Krishna mirroring back that to them, without a literal mirror, but just showing them something. And they're like, well, there we are. The journey is the destination in itself, right? So we don't need to be concerned about, again, the fruits, but the real concern is how to love what I'm doing. The real concern is not so much what's the fruit of what I'm doing. The real concern is how do I get to love what I'm doing? And when I get to love what I'm doing, that's the fruit. No? Wow. Sorry, someone passing with a noisy motorbike here. So the real fruit, again, is not some extraneous result, outcome from what you are doing. The real fruit is to love what you're doing and to love it in such a way that is plausible in eternity. No, both that the thing you are doing is plausible in eternity, and the way you're doing the thing is plausible in eternity. Because some people may say, "Oh, I love killing people." Well, sorry, that's not plausible in eternity. Okay, I'm doing bhakti, but I do not love bhakti. Well, that's not plausible in eternity also. You won't be thrown into a hell where you are practicing a type of bhakti that you hate. So we need to come into terms with loving what we are doing. And this is not by force. Again, if you bully yourself into loving bhakti, that's not loving by to begin with. Right? You cannot bully yourself into love. That's an oxymoron, a contradiction of terms. So it's more of a discovery, a gradual discovery, an art, how to fall in love with this. So yeah, of course, the Brajavasis are the ultimate perfected example of that. They have been always there. And Krishna is just confirming that fact for us sadhakas, to have that reference point and from that build up gradually, sustainably. I don't know if that somehow relates to your question, helps some a little bit.
Oh yeah, it helped a lot. Thank you so much, Maharaj. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was a beautiful question. And maybe we can go one more time to the breakout room for a few minutes, since the last two questions, John and Sam, were somehow related to learning to love what you are doing and so on and so forth. So let's take a few minutes of exploration there and see you soon. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. Every time I say welcome comes to my mind that section of Brihadbhagavatamrita where Gopa Kumara arrives to Golok Vrindavan and Krishna say, "Welcome, welcome. You are more than welcome." And anyhow, a lot happens after that, but the welcome in unto itself is profound. So, hoping you've had some blessed time in the rumination, the nation of to make room. Hopefully you can find Rumi there as well. We'll conclude inviting Manjulali Manjari from the UK. She's there along with Elijah, so I don't know whom of both have something to share today. I invite you to unmute yourself and more than welcome.
Thank you, Hare Krishna Maharaj. So I'm going to head down towards the route of extreme descent now, just
Extreme
because,
descent.
yes,
Okay, let's go.
because
Fasten
I'm
your seatbelt,
about
guys.
I'm about to start the fifth canto again, and it's one that I've always struggled a little bit with at times in terms of the hellish planets, if you think about it in the literal sense. So you speak a lot about that, bridging the gap between, actually you touched upon it, just the previous question about being kind of aligned in this life in terms of the spiritual realm. And I'm also thinking about that, bridging the gap with the lower realm. And just thinking about the hellish planets as a state of consciousness or a place, or thinking about how, if you, in the context of wars, and how some of the war crimes is not that dissimilar to descriptions of the hellish planets. But I guess my question also is around drawing that juxtaposition with the hellish planets and the path of redemption, rehabilitation in the context of Krishna being infinite love. And I'm just thinking of a film, a documentary film that I watched. It probably was about 11, 12 years, and it was called Human, and it was about the commonalities of what it means to be human, the essence of what it is to be human, that kind of deep compassion and empathy. So one of the life stories was a chap that had murdered someone, and so he was talking about his journey of redemption and rehabilitation, and he spoke about how this woman visited him every week in prison throughout his sentence. I think it was about 11 years. And how this woman had really wanted to understand why he had committed this crime, why he had murdered this young man. Anyway, just in a nutshell, at the end of it, he revealed that this woman was the mother of the man that he had murdered, but she had completely, he was saying that she was a Christian, so she'd read the Bible, etc., to him, but he was like breaking down in tears and just saying that because of this other human being that really wanted to understand how I'd come to such a dark place, and her complete forgiveness and unconditional love redeemed his soul. So I'm just thinking, if we think about the rehabilitation in the Bhagavatam, it's quite stark. And I guess it's something at times I've found quite challenging, thinking as a mother, if my son did something terrible, I wouldn't be boiling his head in oil, and I wouldn't necessarily think that that would be the best thing in terms of rehabilitation. So I just wondered if you would be able to shed some light on being able to approach and understand the hellish planets, not just from the literal sense, but how to, but in the context of Krishna being infinitely loving.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's an important question. Has been presented many times, and by this I'm not diminishing at all your presentation of the question. Not on the contrary, it's like validating the importance and bringing the topic every time we need it. In fact, I think it was last year. I've written a series of, I don't know if it was a series or just one, I think it was just one article. Maybe Bhakti Rasa can look for it and share the link in the chat that is on my website about specifically this, which is a summary actually of a chapter of my fourth book, which is not yet published. And it's one sick, the longest chapter of the book is all about suffering. I mean, all about suffering. It's all about, the book is about unconditional love. And then, well, what about suffering? What about pain? And what about horrible stuff? And in that context, what about descriptions of hell? And how much do they, there's the link in this chat, yeah. Hell Revisited, From Terror to Tenderness. Basically, yeah, it's an analysis of how can we navigate that fifth canto. Not only fifth canto, in the third canto there are some sections, but somehow fifth canto has came to be famous or infamous, I should say, unfortunately, because of that. And we missed altogether the story of Jada Bharat and so many incredible parts in the fifth canto. No, it's all about hellish planets. No, that's fifth canto. That's it. And again, in these sections, I will share a few words, but you're invited to go to the article and eventually, yeah, to read that section in the chapter of the book. Yeah, I basically try to go through a non-literal reading of it, not to, of course, cancel altogether that there are consequences to our actions, because there are, and but they are not coming from a vengeful God, so to say, right? Because generally we attached to all the things, we attach an idea of God to it. Because if we say God is God and it's the ultimate person and all this stuff that we attach to God, then whatever happens under his command, he's somehow approving of that. And then if what's happening doesn't make any sense, then we start to develop an idea of God that doesn't make any sense. And the problem is when you are okay with that and you continue practicing your religion, and the idea of God that you had makes no sense and it's incoherent. And then on top of that, you're trying to convince others about joining your religion that you are not fully convinced about even. So we need a coherent God to begin with. And a coherent God, and as it has been described in all mystical traditions, is a god of unconditional love. Now, love is the most defining feature of the divine, if you will. It's not even a feature, it's what God is. So if God's made of unconditional love, then whatever happens and exists is somehow drenched with that essence, no matter which form it takes. And I'm saying this in a context. I'm not saying therefore we can justify anything and just bring unconditional love to sugarcoat the Holocaust or whatever. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there is a God of unconditional love that has been described everywhere. Unconditional love is a reality. Examples like you have given, even without talking about God, you can give another person an experience of unconditional love. That's actually the best way to convey an idea of unconditional love is giving people an experience of that through you, right? Rather than talking up for hours about that and not embodying that yourself. So we are all called to do that. And regarding hellish planets, again, there are different stances, I will say, in the Gaudiya community, as you can imagine, and as we were talking about different levels of reading, some people will literalists, and that's what it is. And if you, whatever you do, this is the corresponding consequence, literally. No boiling down anything, so to say. Some others will be more nuanced, will say, hellish planets, I do believe in the existence of those realms. I may not use the word hellish because already the word hell in the Western psyche, most probably more especially, may trigger certain associations. So, and the word in Sanskrit is not hell literally because hell is an English word, and the words in Sanskrit for hell are more other type of words would indicate downward. Or things like that, you know, like destinies that correspond with low behavior, basically. Some may say it's only a state of consciousness, or there are realms that are like that. But even if they accept that, they will say, if there is chastisement there, if there is a redeeming experience of suffering, it's all with the intention and context of, as you say, rehab, right? Rehabilitation. It's not sheer vengeance and chastisement. But I will say that again, some of this gory, how do you say in English? Like scary depictions are more a device, a literary device to instill some fear in people who sometimes only work through that language. Again, as we talked already in the introduction to the Bhagavatam, different audiences are addressed there, and some people, in some degree, in some situations, only work with fear-based, are fear-oriented. I mean, Vaidhi Bhakti, in one sense, is all about being fear-oriented. Imagine, just even if we speak about bhakti, you have this big division of bhakti or department that is Vaidhi Bhakti, which means you practice, follow rules or regulation. What's the main motivation? The fear of failing in following the full of regulations and the consequences that come from that. If that's your orientation, that's Vaidhi Bhakti. You are a fear-oriented, driven person without stigmatizing the Vaidhi Bhakta. Just that's there for some people. So what to speak again with people outside of Bhakti doing horrible things? Sometimes, yeah, they may need some shocking imagery and disproportionate depictions of chastisement, which many times do not make sense. Sometimes it's like, okay, I don't know, you are at home and you fail to properly honor a guest at home, and for that you will be sent to a hell that you will be boiling in oil for not attending a guest properly for 5 minutes. And it's like, that's too much. That's not proportionate, right? And again, if we take it literally, we will concluding the idea, well, Krishna becomes so easily angry at the slightest fault, I may receive this almost eternal chastisement. So I better become a perfect performer of bhakti and a good boy and girl so I don't go there. And your whole bhakti project becomes traumatized and traumatizing because it's all about not ending there. Nothing positive. And fear and calculation, and it's never enough, and you're never enough, and we always fall short, right? So yeah, I will say, and some other practitioner will say those hellish realms or down inferior realms, if you wish, do not exist at all. I know devotees of all those kinds. They will say all these different things. They will say you already have hell here on earth, as you gave some examples. So I don't think there is a need to speak about different planets. You already can experience that here right now. I may in many ways, most of those who say one thing or the other may not have a direct experience to actually confirm it's there, it's not there. Maybe some ideas may be tied to some form of belief. But whatever stance one takes, I will say, yeah, at least the healthiest stance for me is not to take those sections so literally. Because, and I've seen the consequence of that. So I see them on art as artavat, which is a device in scripture. Artavat means exaggeration, basically. So you exaggerate some things to make a point. Sometimes the exaggeration may go in the direction of praise also, or of numbers, like we were talking the other day in the Bhagavatam, right? Chittu Kirti Maharaj had 10 million wives. I don't think so. And it's fine. Just you want to make a point clear enough, so you expand numbers a little bit. So in this case, you have another form of artavat. If you do this, this will happen to you. And you bring a number that, wow, you are like, I will not do that. Right? Again, that's not the highest form of motivation, but for some people, that's the only language they have learned so far. So at least they prevent them from doing that harmful thing. But the idea is to continue educating that person to learn newer, higher languages. But again, at the end of the day, and I'm basically repeating what you include in your question, which is a very clear idea, is if we want to conceive the existence of those realms, it's more like a karmic healing department, let's put it that way, right? Like you go there to heal, you go there to learn, you go there to deconstruct, unlearn, and relearn. And the imagery and all the details and the boiling oil and the torture, I mean, doesn't need to be taken literal. It's just there. You have to put it literal. You have to just say there are justice departments when you go to experience the fruit of your actions, and the experience comes with the intention of redemption. No, it's not just for you to suffer, just for you to. It's with the intention of you growing and taking responsibility, as I always like to say, taking responsibility for your actions. Because if the goal of life is love, and love is the ultimate responsibility, in love, you really take full responsibility for your whole being. So if I want to take you to love, but love is the ultimate responsibility, if I throw you full love on one side in one moment, that's too much responsibility. So we may need to learn responsibility gradually. So some of these depictions and realities try to convey that lesson. There is some correspondence between what we do, think, say, and that creates an impact in the environment. And we want to be held accountable for that, so we grow in responsibility. Again, it's not about chastisement, revengefulness, and making people suffer, but growing. No, in responsibility, so we eventually can fully bloom in the final responsibility that is love. So that love that is the ultimate responsibility is all the way down present in all these different responsibility departments. You want to call them hellish planet, that's a name only. But the essence of that is growing responsibility, and there is a loving intention behind. And yeah, sometimes there may be a little bit exaggerated and overly depicted things with a certain intention for some people, and for some other people, that's not relatable. And you can skip those sections, no problem. I wouldn't say you are offending the Bhagavatam or something. Again, as we were talking in the Bhagavat series, right? There is a golden thread in the Bhagavatam. Everything else is there for some purpose. Again, all these endless verses with depictions of kings and dynasties, that's not the essence of the Bhagavatam. To be honest, sometimes I'm reading that, I'm skipping those sections. I'm fine. I'm not feeling guilty about like, oh, I'm amputating. I've read those verses, all of them, many times, but at one point it's like, I get the role of these sections, but that's I don't need that. And I'm not saying I'm so advanced or something. It's just by the grace of Bhagavatam, you are able to picture what's the, where is this pointing to. It's like criticizing Sanatana Goswami, why you wrote a commentary on the 10th canto only? Why you didn't comment on the whole Bhagavatam? You skip the whole Bhagavatam, you're just going on the. No, he got this is a golden thread, and I'm focusing there. Everything else goes here, guys. Like making a point. I'm not saying do not read other cantos, but I'm saying there's a point when you start to realize what's the golden thread here, and all the other things find their place, and at one point may not be necessary for you. I don't need to go through some of those sections which where there are or threats of punishment or these heavenly rewards, because there are other sections of scripture which are all about future delights. No, and I don't care for that. So I can understand that's for some other people or for me at some other stage. I have to be honest where I am now and relate to that. So we all have to do that same work. Anyhow, some reflections about hellish planets. If it was not
Thank
enough,
you. No,
my YouTube
that
channel,
was,
you put in the search option hellish, and some other conversation will come because many times that came. But maybe the article will also serve the purpose. So,
Thank you. I really like the growth towards love. That was amazing. Because that does take so much responsibility and the growth of personal responsibility. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, love is the center of reality, as I like to say, so unconditional love. So if we don't see things in the context of that center of reality, we are seeing reality decontextualized. So seeing anything without the presence of unconditional love at its center is decontextualizing anything and everything. So to see everything context, you have to have we have to have the proper centering context, which is unconditional love. And that unconditional love in the center puts everything in context, including so-called hellish planets. Thank you. And okay, we'll go to one final breakout room today to share whatever you would like to share in connection to this last topic, or whatever you would like to share in connection to anything. At the end of the day, everything exists in connection to the center of unconditional love. So see you back in a few minutes for our final goodbye of today. Pranam to all. Welcome back one more time. Hoping you had some blessed time together, and we are putting to rest officially our session today, wishing you a blessed celebration. Today we are celebrating the appearance day of Jahnava Devi, Sita Devi. In a few days you will be celebrating Narasimha Chaturdasi as well. The next day the appearance day of Sri Radha Raman and many other things. Every day is a celebration, don't forget that. So looking forward to cross our paths again next Saturday, same time, same channel, same day, ever new, blooming hearts. Thank you so much, Sriman Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Hari Bol.